All right, good morning. Welcome to the end of week 12 and the end of CS50. Please continue to help yourself to sparkling cider and cake. You'll note that there's a bug in both of the cakes. Chocolate says vanilla, vanilla says chocolate, but we'll leave it to you to eat away at that problem. So it's hard to believe, perhaps, that just 13 weeks ago we started this class with that little tale of opening up these floppy disks and dissecting them, and here you are 13 weeks hence, having done a ridiculous amount of work, perhaps, but hopefully having gotten just a little something out of it. And so today's cake and cider is meant to celebrate that for you guys, if you will. So today is meant to be a bit of a retrospective, a bit of a wrap-up. I wanted to address some of the comments that came back on the surveys, wanted to introduce a couple of additional guests today. But first, let me draw your attention to that bigger board, who either out of sheer cleverness or savvy, Xiang Cao is atop the list with $232,525, having begun, of course, with just $10,000. So if Xiang's here, we'd like to present you with this certificate of achievement. Please come on down and a big round of applause if we could.
Maybe it's $1 million or something.
Yeah.
See us after, please. So on that most recent survey, this was one of you said in response to any other thoughts. There should be an end of the year CS party, so consider that request satisfied. Another student in answer to that question, any other thoughts, gave us this. Finally, a third student gave us this, which I don't know. Frankly, what that means. So let me pause in this lecture now and introduce Professor Hans-Peter Pfister, who will be teaching a new course this spring, Computer Science 171, which explores just how you can use computers in cool ways to present data visually. So, Professor Pfister.
Thanks a lot, David. So I see David has set the bar really high. I'm going to serve cake in the first class, okay? So please come to the class. I'm just going to show a brief number of slides here and introduce my new course. So I'm a new faculty at CS in the computer science department, and I was before for 10 years in industry. So it's a little bit of a shock for me to in academia, as it probably is for you. And this is my first class that I'm officially teaching at the Harvard College, but I've been teaching at the Harvard Extension Schools for about 10 years. So the class is called Visualization, and it's got nothing to do with relaxation techniques, although these might be useful for your finals. We're actually going to look at how we can use images to make data understandable. So as you know, we're all inundated with lots and lots of data, and most of that data is quite hard to understand if you look at it in just its raw form. So this, for example, is a tabulation of the evacuation centers of the recent San Diego fires. Now, it's a lot better to look at that on a map. And what's interesting about this is that a local radio station made a Google mashup and put that information online for all people to see where their closest evacuation center is. So it's now really easy for any one of us to make a visualization and to present that online to a large community. The question really is, what is a good visualization? And that's what we're going to talk about in this class. So this is one that shows the San Diego fires that was presented in the New York Times. And it actually contains an awful lot of information. It has population density in grayscale, and it shows you the current fires, or the fires that happened this year in this dark orange color, and the light orange color shows you what happened a few years ago when they had the previous iteration of those fires. And there is some other information in here that's interesting to people. Now, the question really is, you know, you probably believe that images are important for understanding data, but, you know, what is actually a good image versus a bad image? And so what we're showing here is the election results of the 2004 presidential elections. And you've probably all seen this map. It's the classic, you know, red states versus blue states map, red being for Bush and blue being for Kerry. And unfortunately, it doesn't really tell you the whole truth. Because, as you probably remember, the vote was actually much closer than this map suggests. So Bush won by just a few million votes on the popular vote in 2004. But if you look at the amount of red and blue shown on the map, it's largely red. And does anybody have an idea why that might be? Population density, very good. That's the right answer. So we can first of all look at it just by county, but still, this is way too red, you know, considering what the outcome was. We can actually do a nice cartogram, which is sort of a cool visualization technique that distorts the map based on the population density. But quite frankly, this is hard to understand. And if you didn't know this was the US, you probably wouldn't really get it. You can go to 3D. Everybody loves 3D who plays video games. Unfortunately, as I'll discuss in the class, 3D isn't that great for visualization because it actually distorts a lot of the information and some of it is very hard to see. So here is a nice visualization based on population density. And as you see, in the Midwest, as you probably know, large areas are unpopulated. And so there is really that that white color that dominates this map. And this is an even better visualization where they color the number of votes by population density using the areas of those circles. And then the New York Times decided to actually present their readers all of those different visualizations and then a couple other ones that are interesting to give you a complete view of that data. Now, what's important to learn here is that good visualization is not just a single answer. There is no right answer. And it depends a lot on the task, on the question you're asking, on your audience, and it depends a lot on some principles that we'll teach in the class. Now, fortunately, visualization is really useful for uncovering patterns. So here are two presidential conventions, the Republicans on the left and the Democrats on the right. Again, this is for 2004. And this just shows the frequency of the most popular words that were used during those conventions. And this gives you sort of an idea of what kind of topics were mentioned during the conventions in 2004. What's interesting, for example, is that the Republicans talked a lot more about the opponent, Kerry, than the Democrats did. And you also see sort of the general trends of the kinds of things that they talked about. Since we have today headlines about baseball, I figured I'll show this one. This shows you the batting average of three of the most famous baseball players, Hank Aaron, Babe Ruth, and Barry Bonds. If you look at the red line, this is Barry Bonds. Most other people in their later years actually have this flattening of their batting average, or of their home run average, I should say. And, you know, that's basically due to age. But if you look at Barry Bonds' curve, there is this interesting nick that all of a sudden picks up mid-career. And that's pretty much around the time when they figured that he was starting to use steroids. So in CS171, we'll learn a lot about the basic design and cognitive principles of what makes a good visualization. We learn about various different visualization methods, and you'll actually implement an interactive visualization system for your final project. So it does involve programming, but fortunately all of you here are really well equipped since you survived CS50. And I think actually it will take your programming a step further. We're going to use very likely a nice package called Processing, and you can look it up online. It's based on Java, and it's quite easy to use, and it's object-oriented, so you'll actually learn a lot more programming concepts as well in this class. Here is just a list of topics. I'm not going to go really through this, but needless to say, there is a lot of interesting visualization techniques, including Google Earth and all kinds of cool stuff that we're going to do in the class. So the lectures will be Monday, Wednesday, 1 to 2:30, and very likely we'll have sections Fridays, which are not mandatory. They're just there for you to talk to the TFs. And then we'll have four homeworks, one midterm exam, and a final project that can actually be done in teams, so you can do a project in a team. And before I leave, I just want to also give a plug for CS179. That's another very new class, which will be offered by Lynn Stein in the spring. It's happened that it's actually right after CS171, also Mondays, Wednesdays, 2:30 to 4:30. And she's really going to talk to you about design and interaction, and basically human-computer interfaces. So that's all I had to say. Thanks a lot for your attention.
C7 should see.
You know, I'm not sure we've yet had such a popular Friday, at least not in months. So I actually see some unfamiliar faces, and I'm sure you know who you are better than I. But welcome back, nonetheless. Funny what cake seems to do.
All right.
Let me now take a moment and reintroduce my mentor, Dr. Henry Leitner, who will be finishing up with a couple of cool demos based on that language called Lisp and functional programming in general that we began last week. So, Dr. Leitner.
So even though I'm not teaching CS51 this spring, I thought I'd just continue with the one lighthearted demonstration, which I didn't quite get a chance to do with you last week. So let me just log in quickly, and this will take no more than perhaps 5 minutes. Where am I going? That edu, right? Harvard. Did they change it? My socks are wet. I'm having trouble typing. All right, so here we go. So if you were here or if you watched the video last week, I spend most of the time trying to give you the sense that Lisp as a functional programming language can deal with functions as first-class objects. And even though I didn't show you the code, if you take a look at the handout, in just 5 lines, I wrote a program that computes the definite integral of any function by essentially summing up a bunch of rectangles that you can have of any width, the width being dx, under this curve. So let me just get through the slide and go on to the next example. Lisp historically has had a wonderful reputation because of its prowess in dealing with what we call symbolic pattern matching. And as an example, I decided to show you a little function, or maybe not show you the code, but at least demonstrate a function that will match what I've described as a pattern against some actual data. So remembering that Lisp deals with lists of symbols perhaps, here's a simple pattern that says, color, apple, red. Now that's not very much of a pattern because the only thing that this could possibly match up successfully against would be a list that has exactly those same symbols in it, color, apple, red. But once you start to introduce the notion of what we describe as wildcard variables, the sorts of things you actually use already, presumably, when you're interacting with the Unix operating system, you could say, for example, the presence of a question mark is going to signify successful matching against any single atomic value. So this pattern, color apple question mark, would match not only against color apple red, but against color apple anything. Now there's nothing semantic going on here. This is purely syntactic because, of course, you know, we could say color apple foobar and we would also have a successful match. Another possibility would be to use a wildcard variable asterisk. Instead of matching against a single atomic value, asterisk, as is kind of true in Unix with slight differences, can match against a sequence of 0 or more atoms. How many of you have ever issued the famous Unix command, something like, rm star? Anybody done that? You know what that does, of course, right? And when it says, are you sure? You know what that means. So the idea is that A question mark B can match against successfully AAB, but not AB nor ABC, because the question mark, the B and the C don't match at the end. A star B, since star can match against 0 or more atoms, can successfully match against AB. In that case, the star matches nothing. Also against AXYZB. And finally, the pattern star X star Y matches any sequence containing both X and Y in that order, because you can have any number of atoms in between the X and the Y. The star matching those. So finally, what happens is, if we really want to write a pattern matcher that exhibits some sort of intelligence, maybe we can extend the notion of these wildcards to having them attached to little variable names. So in other words, a question mark with a little variable next to it, like X, would not only match successfully against this atom red, but the value red would end up being stored in the variable named X. And that requires a little bit of a kludge. If any of you are actually going to be looking at the Lisp code, you'll discover that somehow there has to be a way in my program to take question mark X and break it apart. I mean, think about doing that in C. Suppose you had a variable and you wanted to take a variable and take its name and pull it apart so that part of the name can be used for storing information and the rest could be thrown away, perhaps. So that's a little trick. Lisp is very flexible, obviously. I mean, you may have gathered that from the little demo I did last week. Similarly, star variable would use to be matched against zero or more atoms, but somehow we'd store that sequence that it matched against in the variable name. So what this all comes down to is the following. By having a cleverly chosen sort of set of patterns against which we will match, we can actually write a very rough version of a Rogerian psychotherapist program. And again, this is historically significant because this goes back to some of the earliest days of artificial intelligence when a fellow by the name of Joseph Weizenbaum at MIT, as part of his PhD thesis, actually produced such code. And if you Google ELISA, Lisp, psychotherapy, you'll find plenty of examples online, probably many of them done in Java, perhaps, Java applets, that you can interact with. But the heart of the program, basically, is a bunch of these conditional clauses. So for example, if it says, I would like to match the pattern, I am worried, followed by blah, 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 whatever, and then that would be looked at as data, your user input, you could simply respond, as a Rogerian psychotherapist might, with, well, how long have you been worried? And then just regurgitate what the blah, blah, blah sequence was. So if you take a look at the code, which I'm not going to trouble you with right now, you'll see just a handful of these patterns in a little program whose name is Doctor. Let me load it in and do a quick little demonstration to show you how, it's a bit of a charade, but how far you can go with pattern matching to produce an illusion. And here's the program. All right, so the program is expecting me just to, I'm the patient, the program is the psychotherapist, and it's expecting me just to type a series of comments. So I'll say, hello there. All right, I am really worried about this CS50 course. Well, I'm not even worried about the CS50 course. Ever since my mother first warned me about Anna. Well, they are all into computers and leather, I think. Yes. Please do not be so short with me. I am not short. I am almost 5'8" inches on a good day. Wow, you are one heck of a psychotherapist. Did you graduate from Yale? Whoa. Anyway, the actual code has, I think, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. It has, I think, only 8, maybe 9 different patterns that it's looking for. For example, one of the patterns says, if ever I mention the word mother, the pattern is actually star, mother, star. If ever I mention the word mother, it sets a little local variable called the mother flag to true. And if I ever type anything that it doesn't understand, it simply looks at the mother flag, and if it finds that it's been set to true, it says, oh, earlier you spoke of your mother. And then it sets the mother flag back to false, or nil, as we say in Lisp. You know, but I mean, you know, you could go on and on like this. You know, you could say, There was an I wish one. I wish you were human or something like that. Tell me why you wish me were human. So it's not quite grammatical. Anyway, I have had quite enough. All right. Now, how many of you, has anybody here heard of the Turing test of intelligence, which Alan Turing sort of, not devised, but postulated in the 1950s? Can anybody tell me, anybody want, is willing to say what that Turing test is about? Yes. To learn, well, okay, that's
defined as being conscious, the ability to take in information and process it.
That's right. I mean, that's the broader view of human intelligence that Turing was troubled about. But what he actually did ultimately was to simplify this idea into something much more basic. Yes. That's right. If you just go to Wikipedia or some other, you know, place on the web, you'll find a very simple statement of the problem in which what Turing, this is back in the 1950 actually, in computing machinery and intelligence, a human judge engages in a natural language conversation with one human and one machine, each of which try to appear human. If the judge cannot reliably tell which is which, then the machine is said to pass the test. In order to keep the test simple and universal, to explicitly test the linguistic capability of the machine, instead of its ability to render words into audio, the conversation is usually limited to text typing. So let me just end with the following anecdote, which is actually true. It sounds somewhat apocryphal, but it's true, because it turns out that some time ago at a company in Cambridge called Bolt, Beranek, and Newman, which coincidentally is generally credited with inventing the internet, a version of Weizenbaum's ELISA psychotherapist program might have inadvertently passed the Turing test of intelligence. And it goes as follows. There was an account written in the communications of the ACM SIGART newsletter in which the following incident apparently happened. It's written by Danny Barbrow, who was one of the principal research scientists at BBN back then. He describes it as follows. One Saturday morning at about 9 a.m., a BBN vice president in charge of selling our telecom commercial service arrived at our PDP-1 computer room hoping to be able to use the computer for a demo. He found a note on the PDP-1 teletype that read, "Please type all messages into this teletype and end them with a period." This note had been left there by one of the programming bums who had just succeeded in making run a Lisp version of the Doctor program based on ELISA as developed by Weizenbaum. However, the vice president thought this note indicated that the teletype was actually linked with the one in my home, since I often use the computer all night long. Therefore, he started typing to, quote unquote, me, but in fact was typing to this version of the Doctor program. The following conversation ensued. Vice president, do you think that I can use the computer this morning? Teletype, why do you ask? Vice president, I might be able to make some additional telecom sales. Teletype, why aren't you sure? Vice President, well, my prospective customers have never seen a demonstration of the system. Teletype, does this mean very much to you? Vice President, of course it does. Teletype, you seem very positive about that. I mean, think about what Rosarian psychotherapists do. They regurgitate little bits and pieces of what you've just told them. Vice President, this is ridiculous. Teletype, what do you mean this is ridiculous? Vice President, is there any reason why I can't use the computer now? Teletype, please tell me more about your prospective customers. Like, please tell me more about your family. Vice President, please dial me up right now on 491-1850. So now the author interrupts. He says, note that after the last remark, the Vice President did not obey the instructions, left out the period, and therefore the computer didn't answer him. This so infuriated the Vice President, who thought I was playing games with him, he called me up, woke me up from a deep sleep, and said, Vice President, why are you being so snotty to me? Bob Rao, what do you mean, why am I being so snotty to you? All yours. By the way, I should mention, by the way, unless CS51 has changed a lot since I last taught it, one of the capstone project is that you'll be actually creating a substantial fraction of a Lisp interpreter, which is a nice, wonderful software engineering project, and I suspect that's still true. Anyway, All yours.
Thank you to both of these guys. This Hans. Momentary switch, help yourself to anything in back. And. Well, we left off with Buff Druids. So, one final respondent, in answer to any other thought, gave us this. Okay, I like this course. That was fantastic. Mind you, though, this was on the heels of Problem Set 7 survey, which was on the heels of Problem Set 5 survey, so this student also happened to tell us this. So, no more surveys from us, but let me point out, frankly, just how useful these things have been, to be honest. Having feedback from 200-plus students is enormously helpful, particularly as we look ahead for next semester and your peers at this school. In particular, I thought I would give you a couple of teasers of some of the data we looked at and then also address some of the concerns and also convey some of the ideas that we are considering for next fall, particularly if and when your own friends ask you, should I not take that particular course? Well, somewhat curiously, it looks like a bunch of you are slackers. So we hand these things out 7 days in advance, and yet the most popular day to begin is, in fact, Wednesday, with about a quarter of you beginning then. That's not all that unreasonable, because frankly, even I sort of wait until the pressure is on to do things. Some of you true slackers wait until Friday morning, which is remarkable, and then some of the truer geeks in the class, to be sure, begin Friday night, the same day that it's actually released. But it's certainly an interesting spectrum that we'll keep in mind, to be honest, as we plan office hours and the like in future terms. Now, speaking of office hours, I do still need to consider some of these ideas, but one of the experiments we're considering running next year in order to better manage the load in the office hours that you guys experienced this year are a couple of things. One, we might end up hiring office hour specific TFs, particularly former students, among them yourselves, who would then help out students in the computer lab during office hours, but wouldn't necessarily engage in the grading and the leading of sections, which I know some of you, while you might be comfortable lending a hand with problem sets you yourself had to struggle through, might not yet feel comfortable or feel savvy enough yet to stand in front of an entire class. So know that that might be one of the roles we'll be recruiting for over the next several weeks and months. And what we might also consider doing on an experimental basis is a fast lane of sorts in the computer lab. So it is not uncommon that some of you guys have just had very quick questions, which frankly any one of the teaching staff could answer in about 2 seconds or certainly under 60 seconds. So what we might try doing as well is having, in effect, two lists of names on the whiteboard, one for the quick questions, one for the I need some help, could you sit beside me kinds of questions, the first list of which would be limited to 60-second questions and responses, and if a TF determines that your question is not going to take just 60 seconds, we'll just push that student over to the other list. But the idea then would be we would have one teaching fellow dedicated in the lab on certain nights to just these express lane questions, whereby they would float from student to student as rapidly as possible, just trying to increase our throughput. So keep that in mind as well, perhaps as you chat with your friends. I thought I'd offer you a reminder as to where you all fit within the euphemistic spectra that we offered in this course, those less comfortable, those more comfortable, and somewhere in between. Needless to say, none of these percentages is trivial. So we certainly have a broad range of students in this class, perhaps explains the fact that on certain problem sets, on certain quizzes, some of you find these things very easy and very quick to do, like those crazy kids that spend 0 to 5 hours on these problem sets, as opposed to those of you, more like me, who spent 10-plus, 15-plus on occasion. So we've certainly had a spectrum, but I do think that's largely inevitable in introductory courses like these. But with that said, what we've done is preened 283 potential TFs, graders, coders, and I don't know what to call the last yet, so office hourers, to help out with this coming fall 2008. So you'll hear from us likely via email in the weeks to come, pinging you explicitly if you might be interested in such, but know that it is not too soon to drop me a note if that's a role that you might be interested in. Now, before we do our quick retrospective here and let you adjourn with your cider and cake at class's end, let me pause for a moment and acknowledge the folks who really made this class what it is. I mean, it is without a doubt that at the end of the day, it's the teaching fellows of this course that you remember, and it's the teaching fellows of this course that are quite literally there in the trenches with you. So I'd like us to take a moment, if you'd humor me, and give these guys a huge round of applause. not sure if you stop when I stop, so I guess I'll just stop there. So in particular, to Thomas and Katie, our course's head teaching fellows, without whom none of this could have happened, especially given that we had a staff of 23 teaching fellows, and just managing that alone was a huge challenge for them and a huge success as well. So my thanks to those two in particular. If you're wondering who Link there is on the board, Glenn Holloway is a man who's worked largely behind the scenes, but is a man who mentored me as well during graduate school and knows more than I will ever, let's see, what's the expression, more than I will ever forget, something like that, where this is the man I turn to when I don't know the answer to some question in C, some Linux question. Up until now, he's refused to give us a photograph of himself, but he is known as this symbol on our research group's homepage, so I went with that as instead, so our thanks to him as well. Those of you, several of you here today, know that this course has videos, apparently, and I'd like to take one moment to acknowledge as well a woman who's not technically even on staff. Chris Thayer is actually a former Extension School student of mine who is an aspiring photog and videog and is wonderfully interested in and skilled at video production. And every one of the videos that was produced this semester for this course were not done, as you know, by FAS Computer Services, but single-handedly in Chris Thayer's home with our own DV tape equipment. So a huge thank you to her, who's been doing this purely on this saint-like volunteer basis. So if we could, because she's watching us, give her a round of applause as well. That would be great. And our thanks as well to a man who's never appeared on camera, but Tom Lehman, who sits behind the camera and makes all of those videos possible. And I know there's a bunch of you who should be applauding for him as well. So a big hand for him. All right, so let's see if we can move away now from the applause and wrap this thing up. So respondent number 48 gave us this. And the funny thing is, I mean, it's kind of true. I think one of the best things the college has done in the past year or so is introduce this idea of minors for various reasons, but particularly from a self-interested perspective, as the school, what is now the School of Engineering and Applied Sciences, does very much try to attract and lure additional students to the ranks of engineering and applied sciences at Harvard. So even if we haven't turned most of you into majors, which certainly is not to be expected in a class of this size, hopefully we have teased you enough and given you a taste of enough of computer science so that you might continue on with another three or more courses so as to put computer science down as your major. And I should note, too, that this course... What just happened? I should note, too, that this course is... Am I the only one? There?
Not me.
Okay. Laser pointer? No? All right. So I should note that this course is very much a part of Harvard's history. And frankly, it's just been an honor for me to be a part of it and just to be a little blip on the 10, 20-year history that this course itself has had. Its previous incarnations were such numbers as CS150, other numbers as well. But perhaps the course that I want to draw attention to, even though it's many, many years old, is this course formerly called Natural Sciences 110, Automatic Computing. This is a course that was around 30 years ago, but I went through the Crimson recently because this was the computer science course, and Henry can certainly correct me if I'm wrong, at Harvard sort of back in the day when none of the students at this school certainly even had desktop computers, certainly not laptop computers, but this was the course you took if you wanted to get a taste of computer science. And fortunately, these days we have many other entry points to the School of Engineering, Henry's own Computer Science 1, Computer Science 50, Hans Peters courses, Matt Welsh's course, Radhika Nabkal course, all of these different courses that you can take from largely an introductory perspective, but this was the course back in the day, and this is a quote from the Crimson, the entrance of Natural Sciences 110, an introductory computer course, into the top 10 at sixth position reflects a new interest in computer technology. So that was 1969, a new interest in computer technology. There's another quote that I dug up a few years later, testament to just how much, frankly, things have changed, and relatively quickly. I was even alive in this year. Students must sign up, according to the Crimson, at least a day in advance for the single hour of computer time they are allowed each day. My God, if you guys can even imagine being limited to doing your problem sets in just 1 hour, I mean, things have certainly changed. But things have certainly changed just in terms of enrollment. So I went through old Q guides and pulled data from Harvard University's archives. And NatSci 110 was offered for many years, but the data that I looked at was back around 1960s, 1970s. And you can see that this course, Natural Sciences 110, Introduction to Computer Science, was one of the largest courses at Harvard at one point. A bunch of geeks were sitting in Sanders Theater, of all places, learning about technology and computer science. And it peaked there, or might even gone up a bit further, around 1981, when the course had over 700 students. So this is to say that we do hope that we might reinvigorate this interest in technology, the School of Engineering and Applied Sciences. It's ironic, perhaps, that the more technology you guys have in your pockets and the more you have in your homes, it almost seems maybe the less interested we all are in understanding that stuff. And what we hope this course in particular has done is at least give you a sense of how that stuff does in fact work, and perhaps interest you a bit more intellectually in some of the things that are now omnipresent, but that 13 weeks ago most of you perhaps took for granted and certainly didn't fathom understanding exactly how that iPhone or other such device might possibly be working. In fact, a funny takeaway from introductory courses like these is that the world starts to make, dare say, a bit more sense, right? Matt Welsh last week reminded us of this famed screen, Windows' blue screen of death, which persists in different forms. Microsoft likes to change the aesthetics every few years, but still pretty much exists. And, 13 weeks hence, and frankly, maybe even today, this might look a bit cryptic, but at least when you start seeing crazy things like 0E and 0028C00, at least you have a sense that that's probably hex. Maybe it's referring to some address. I might not know myself how to go about fixing this thing, but at least it might not be as scary. I mean, odds are your takeaway from screens like this henceforth should be that you didn't screw up, someone else screwed up, and whoever wrote this virtual device driver that triggered this blue screen of death is in fact at fault because they too are just human.
I got one of those on my GPS device and it hurts rental car a few months ago, yeah.
Not good. I mean, actually, I didn't include it in today's screenshots, but I've seen screenshots of this thing on airport arrival departure terminals, on ATM machines. It's not a good thing. I did pull from the interweb, so to speak, a few other such instances, which, yes, are meant to be a bit funny, but also should now make sense because you should have an idea of what went wrong, not with the program, but with the guy or person fixing or trying to catch this error. This is an error message from one program. You can sort of imagine how that might have happened, forgetting to pass in the actual string. What about this one? I mean, that's infuriating, perhaps. You might see in your life, henceforth, such things as this. Now, this one's a bit scary looking. What's a little funny, if not condescending, if that the computer is now saying the memory could not be read, as though, you might not understand that unless it were in finger quotes. But at least, this is Windows incarnation, odds are, of, core dump, a segmentation fault, right? The instruction at such and such an address, reference memory at such and such an address. Now, frankly, no user cares about that, and odds are the programmer who made that mistake is never going to see that message, but at least now, such things as these on your PCs and Macs might make a bit more sense. I'd be remiss if I didn't offer this one up for your consideration, since it's canonical in the realm of error messages. And then finally, perhaps as bad as it can get is a little something like this. So anyhow, that's me late at night on Google Images there. So what did you guys do in this course? It's sort of hard to imagine, at least for me, and dare say for some of you, that it wasn't all that long ago that we were playing with little cats and screens, and men were raining down from the screens, but we very quickly moved on to C and these higher-level languages. Although C, as you know from Matt Welsh's talk, is in fact itself rather low-level, in contrast to something like PHP. So in week one, we began introducing some of the syntax of this language, which known as C. We looked in week two at some additional features of C, return values, functions, frames, and things got a bit more technical. And those of you who had never programmed before or who had perhaps programmed in safer languages like Java and the like didn't necessarily know as much about what was going on underneath the hood. And we integrated this real-world domain of crypto just to give you a fun environment in which to explore not only syntax but some of these ideas, arrays and memory and the like. Well, then we took things up a higher level, recall. So you had, after just 2-3 weeks of this course, a good amount of the syntax involved in programming in C and programming in general. And so we introduced some of the most canonical problems in computer science, namely searching and sorting, this basic principle of recursion, all of which will recur if you take future courses in computer science, particularly ones in data structures. But hopefully in this course, you got a sense, if not a mastery, of precisely those problems. We looked, of course, at debugging and introduced GDB and some other fundamental approaches to solving problems in the week that followed. Memory management, and perhaps this was not so much your friend by the time problem set 6 rolled around, since many of you struggled or fought with Valgrind just to eliminate your memory leaks and memory errors, but hopefully at the end of all of that you did in fact overcome. And then finally, and actually, this was only in week 6, even though it feels, at least to me, just like yesterday, we looked at some of these other canonical data structures that, provided you put a little more thought and intelligence into the design of your software, you can make not only theoretical improvements, but also real-world improvements. Case in point, your speller program for problem set 5. We looked as well at binary search trees and tries, heaps. Can we do better than what we had just done 2 or 3 weeks prior? In week 8, we looked at Huffman coding, a real-world incarnation of why trees in memory might be useful, and we looked even deeper underneath the hood. All these things we'd been taking for granted, like GCC and Make, what's really been going on? And we teased those apart, and you can learn more, certainly, about those in a compiler's course or in other hardware-related courses. Week 9, Mike Smith joined us and talked a bit about security and talked a bit about insecurity. And I actually, in looking back at week 0's lecture 0, remembered that I had promised that in this course you should ask me why there's a canary on this slide. Well, frankly, no one ever asked, so I'm not going to tell you. But you should have sufficient skill sets now with which to go out on Google and Wikipedia and the like and understand just how these canaries relate to computer security. So consider that your last homework assignment for me. And then in week 10, we brought things up to the real world. It is, dare say, the future of software development to run on the web. And you see this in the form of all of Google's many applications, as well as others. And I would go so far as to say that this is inevitable. And that's the bet I'm willing to make. But I do think that this era of running client-side software that you download or install from shrink-wrap boxes with CDs is probably going to be increasingly behind us as time passes. And it might not be the web on which we're running software ultimately, but at least to me, personally, it makes a lot of sense that we're moving in this direction. And so week 10 was about providing you with precisely the skill set or the familiarity, not only with how to program in some language other than Scratch and other than C, but to give you the means of expressing yourself in perhaps this more real-world context. We looked as well at some lower-level details in week 11, wrapping up our discussion of the web. And then, and this was foreshadowed, in week 0, we promised this guy holding a cup of bubbly in the very first lecture. And here, of course, we are now. So there is one other respondent, I think, that I should probably show you. So respondent number 3, in answer to any other thoughts, gave us this. So I think we would be remiss if we didn't end on this. You applaud me, but this is actually a little awkward because I actually stole this phone book ripping gag from my mentor. For Henry Leitner and CS50, farewell and congrats, guys.